Well, the Sermon on the Plain, which was different than the Sermon on the Mount, you find the Sermon on the Plain recorded for us in Luke chapter 6. Jesus made a statement that probably shocked some of the most religious people who were in the audience there that day. He said, "Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation." Well, a few months later, Jesus responds to a request from a fella who asked Jesus to make sure that his brother shared with him the inheritance that he had coming. And Jesus told this story about this rich man who had much and was preparing to have more, but never made plans for eternity. Luke chapter 12, we read that story. Well, now it appears, beginning in Luke chapter 15, in very quick succession, Jesus tells about three stories here that all have to do with the same kind of ideas. You have the prodigal son that we studied a few weeks ago in chapter 15, who went out and wasted all of his money, all of his inheritance. Well, now you have this story in chapter 16 about this manager who wasted his owner's possessions and mishandled that money. Next, we're going to read the story about the rich man and Lazarus, another story about a man who did not prepare for eternity. That'll be in chapter 16, verse 19 through 31. Following that, you have Jesus with his confrontation with the rich young ruler, Luke chapter 18. Finally, you have the story of Zacchaeus, the tax collector who God brought into the kingdom and who got a whole different view about his possessions, Luke chapter 19. Now, I assume from all of this evidence that Jesus cares about our view of money. In fact, he thinks it's quite important. However, the lessons that Jesus teaches us in all these stories almost always conflict with our very normal, typical desires of the flesh, like our greed and our covetousness, our jealousy, our envy. We know what that feels like. We not only experience these things in our own life, but we see way too much evidence of this kind of stuff in our world. In fact, our world, our culture is made up of this. A couple of weeks ago, you know the story by now if you read the news at all. Antonio Brown, very, very gifted wide receiver in the NFL, reached a breaking point in his relationship with the Oakland Raiders, asked to be released from his contract. Now, according to all the gossip sheets and all the so-called news, the problem was Brown just refused to attend training camp, and he refused to start the season because he had these disagreements with the management, disagreements with the coach of the Oakland Raiders. Now, this happens to be the same guy who in 2017 was offered a contract by the Pittsburgh Steelers for $68 million. Well, in March of this year, with about $39 million still remaining on that contract, he got in all kinds of trouble with the Steelers management. He decided that he was going to walk away, and the Raiders were more than happy to offer him a three-year contract worth $50 million. Well, the problem was Brown didn't care too much about the authorities who were trying to tell him how to play football, and he thought he knew much more, so he decided to walk away. No problem. There were standing the New England Patriots. And they were more than happy to offer Antonio Brown a one-year contract worth $15 million only 24 hours after he walks away from the second team in 3 years or 3 months that he had walked away from. Now, if you're thinking that whole scenario just sounds pretty ridiculous to me, well, you're thinking like I'm thinking. Now, I'm sorry, but in my opinion, there is no one worth that kind of money. No one, except possibly maybe preachers and their fellow Christians. Some who really do take in an astronomical salary. This time I'm not talking about me. Of course, there are those nice guys. There's this really well-known famous preacher you probably know about who refuses to take the $200,000 a year salary that his church offers to him. But he doesn't need to. It's estimated his net worth is over $50 million. In fact, according to flyers and articles that come across my desk quite regularly, huge salaries for Christian servants, it's not only acceptable, it's God's will. Just read the flyers. It's the old health, wealth, prosperity gospel that used to be taught back in the 1980s by the charismatics. Well, now it's gone mainstream. And now you can hear this kind of message that God wants you to be wealthy. That's the gospel. And you hear it from the charismatics. You hear it from the liberal churches. You hear it from the evangelical churches. You even hear it from Catholic churches. And the advertisements that I'm reading that advertise seminar after seminar and conference after conference make it very clear that this new wrinkle really is God's will. And who doesn't want to hear that it's God's will for me to be filthy rich? Well, frankly, I think it's just a lot safer and a lot better for us to listen to Jesus' teaching on how to handle our finances. And he's given us plenty of teaching. And what we discover is, contrary to popular opinion, God really does not force all of his people into a box of poverty. In fact, what you actually discover is that sometimes God even makes some of his servants fairly wealthy. And at the very same time, it's God's will for some of his servants to just kind of get by. And I think most of us would be able to say, along with Paul the Apostle and his experience, that we know what it's like to have times when we have abundance. And we know what it's like to have times when we have need. And from the story that Jesus gives us here in our text today, what we're going to learn is how much money we have really is not the important issue. The important issue is, what is our attitude about what God has given us? And that becomes very obvious. We don't have to say a word. It becomes very obvious in how we manage his gifts and his benefits. The story is given to you here in the first 8 verses of our text. You notice that Jesus addressed this story to the disciples who are in there somewhere. Am I dead? You may have to help me out today. Look at verse 1. He also said to the disciples. And as soon as you see that term, disciples, you know exactly who that's talking about. Generally, we think that's the 12 apostles, but it's not. The apostles were distinct from the disciples. There were a lot more disciples than just 12. These are people who just kind of hung around with Jesus. They were followers who were important. They weren't as important as the 12 apostles to whom Jesus was going to turn over the ministry, with the exception, of course, of Judas Iscariot. Disciples is more of a general term. It speaks of those people who were included, the larger mass of people who followed Jesus fairly regularly throughout his gospel ministry. That being true, then, we can kind of go back in our mind to a few sermons ago where the Pharisees were kind of upset with Jesus. Because why? Beginning of chapter 15, the sinners and tax collectors were gathering around Jesus. And so it's entirely possible when Jesus addresses this story to his disciples, that very well could include some of those tax collectors who had a notorious reputation about the way they handled money. In fact, of the 40 parables, allegories, and analogies that Jesus told, 1/3 of them are about money. It must be an important issue. So this is an important story, which gives us a very important lesson about this man who runs into this conflict, and because of the conflict, he has some great concern. He's caught being wasteful. Look at verse 2, for example. Last part of verse 1, verse 2. There's a rich man who had a manager. Charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, "What is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be a manager." Now, more than ever, you need to understand that this is a story that Jesus made up. Okay, that's the nature of a parable. Jesus created this story in order to teach a particular truth, a very important lesson. Because this manager, mark this manager is a loser in every way. There's no way, shape, or form that Jesus is trying to make this manager look admirable. look like the kind of person you ought to emulate, kind of characteristics you ought to have. You shouldn't. This manager is incompetent. In fact, the word that is translated, wasting, he was guilty of wasting his owner's possession, his master's possessions. It is the exact same word that is used in chapter 15, verse 13, to talk about what the prodigal son did with his inheritance. He scattered it everywhere. He wasted it. He was irresponsible with that which was given to him. And so the word really means to just scatter it around irresponsibly. That's not what managers are supposed to do with their master's possessions. In fact, it's quite the opposite of the biblical standard that we see for managers or stewards that is stated in the Word of God by Paul the Apostle. For example, he said, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 2, this is the standard. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found trustworthy. That's the standard that God would have for anybody who's in this position of manager. This was a manager of a household. And because he's a manager of the master's household, that means more than just that he's managing stuff in a house. He is responsible to manage all of the income and all the expenses of the manager's business, of the master's business. He has a very, very huge responsibility, and he has to be trustworthy. Well, this guy wasn't, which implies that the guy was also deceptive. That becomes very clear to us, verse 5 through verse 7. Verse 8 makes it very clear he was dishonest. So what's the master going to do? Well, obviously, according to the story Jesus told, he fires the guy because he's dishonest, because he's incompetent. He's deceptive. Verse 2, you can no longer be manager. But notice verse 2, in my opinion, and that's all it is, manager, the master makes a big mistake here. Instead of firing the guy and say, you're done right now, he said, now I want you to wrap things up here. Make an accounting. You know, bring in all the evidence of how you've accounted for my stuff. And he lets him stay on the job so he can do damage, which is what he does. So having received his pink slip, the manager rightly wonders, you know, what am I going to do? Verse 3, manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. So basically, he gives himself two options. This is what he could do. He could dig or he could beg. Now, living a life seated behind a desk, figuratively, pushing papers, writing numbers, he's probably not the most physically fit guy, right? He's right. He can't dig. And being a very important person, because his manager, no doubt, is a businessman. His master's a businessman, and he owns a lot. And this manager's in a position of authority. He has a very important position in life, and he can't go out and beg. That'd be too embarrassing. He'd be ashamed. So the whole point of the story is that when this man faces this dilemma, I'm losing my job, what am I going to do? He's very shrewd in how he solves the conflict. That's the point of Jesus' story. Notice how this conflict is resolved. He chooses to use his position of authority, his standing. As long as he has this period of time, this short time remaining that the master gave him, he's going to use his position to prepare for his future. Verse 4, I've decided what to do so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So, notice that's future. He's still on the job, and I am going to be removed from management. And while I'm here, I'm going to do something to ingratiate other people to me so that they will kind of owe me something. They'll be obligated to me. And notice the kind of people he's dealing with, not beggars and diggers. He's dealing with businessmen, fellow farmers. We're assuming they're pretty wealthy people based on the way these bills turn out. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Now, what he's counting on here is a first century Jewish practice. Reciprocal kindness. You're familiar with this. Because Jesus already pointed out this very common practice when he's talking about inviting people to the banquet. Remember, we studied that a few weeks ago? And what did Jesus say according to the story, Luke chapter 14, verse 12? He said also to the man who had invited him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you are repaid. That was pretty typical. That was reciprocal kindness. This guy's going to capitalize on that. He knew his culture. And so he comes up with this resolution. And it's quite questionable. Verse 5, so summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He says, sit down, take your bill, write 50. Said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, take your bill, write 80. This is brilliant. He sits down and looks at all the creditors. And he says, well, here's a guy owes my master a lot of money. 100 measures of oil. That was 875 gallons of olive oil from crushed olives. You know how many trees typically full of olives it would take to make 875 gallons of olive oil? 150 trees. You know what that was equivalent to? That would be 3 years' wages for your common laborer. 3 years. You can kind of figure it out in your dollars. So what does this manager do? He cheats his master out of a year and a half of wages. Now that's a lot of money. 50 measures versus 100 measures. You know, sit down and write out $433 worth. Or 433 barrels worth, gallons worth. Then he goes to the guy who owes his master wheat, and he says, listen, you know, to even this thing up, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a 20% discount. Now, 100 measures of wheat would have been equivalent to 10 years' wages for the common laborer. By giving a 20% discount, accepting 80 measures, he just robbed his manager of 2 years' wages. And the debtor was delighted. Of course he would be. Now, what's so shocking about this story is what Jesus says next. Notice the master's response. I mean, he's responding to a manager who's obviously dishonest, and the master knows this. He admits that the guy is dishonest. It's not that the master's deluded. It's not that the master's living in denial. He knows exactly what is going on. He knows exactly what the manager has done. And this part of the story makes absolutely no sense to us if we use common sense and think of righteousness. The master commended him. Verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. Why in the name of common sense did the master do that? Really, try to figure this thing out. Really, even the people who heard this story, they were going to be shocked at what Jesus said. Just like the Pharisees were absolutely shocked when the prodigal comes home having wasted all of his inheritance and his father runs to meet him and embraces him and loves him, and the Pharisees were shocked about that. That should never have happened. But I want you to notice something in this story. The master did not commend the manager for being dishonest. He did not commend him for being undependable, to be unfaithful, untrustworthy. I mean, he couldn't commend him for anything like that. He wasn't any of that stuff. What does he commend him for? What he was. He was shrewd. That's the word. And in our language, that word shrewd almost always has a negative connotation. You know, you really don't want someone to walk up to you and say, you know, I've been watching you and I just feel like you're really shrewd. So, you know, you don't say that to people as a compliment. That kind of makes us think of someone who's a conniver or a crook or a con artist. They're shrewd. Well, that's what this guy was. But that's not exactly what the master is commending in this fellow. What he's saying is, you have exercised common practical sense. I would use the word street smarts. You know what street smarts are? Those are people who know how to get along on the street. You know, they know how to stay out of trouble. They know what to say. They know what not to say. They know when to speak. They know when not to speak. That's shrewd. But that doesn't mean that the manager's okay. You know, everything that he did was totally unacceptable. But, and here's the point. He did exercise human wisdom in order to prepare for his future. That's what the master is saying. Again, it's a parable. It's a story. I mean, we know in real life, in real life, this guy gets prosecuted and goes to jail, right? Yeah, this is a story. And the lesson Jesus is teaching is not that dishonesty is acceptable. The lesson is the importance of Christ's followers to use what blessing God has given for the future. That's the lesson. That's what Jesus is teaching us here. Be as wise, have as much street smarts as this shrewd fellow, as you use what God gives you to prepare for the future. That's the lesson. It's a principle of faithfulness. Even though it's somewhat of an enigmatic conclusion that Jesus gives us here, it leads us to a couple of questions we just have to ask. We're forced to ask these questions. Like, number one, is it really good for us to be shrewd? Is that what Jesus is saying? Yeah, it looks like it in verse 8. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Now, this term, the sons of this world, is talking about people who are unsaved. People who are not born again. They are the children of disobedience. They are the children who are deserving wrath, Paul calls them in Ephesians chapter 2. These are unsaved people. They are sinners who live in a world where their only hope, as far as they're concerned, is the passing things of this world. And so what do they do in that kind of a world? Well, they exercise diligence. They exercise wisdom. They're very shrewd in preparing for their future here where stuff is passing away. And so they deceive each other. And they're dishonest with each other. They get one up on their friends and they take their associates to the woodshed as they rob them. Now, you don't have to do that. But wait a minute. Think of the world you live in. How many of you have ever received an advertisement of some kind encouraging you to buy some insurance that's called long-term health insurance? You know what that really is? That's nursing home insurance. Is it wise to prepare for your future by doing that? One would think so. You're encouraged to get together and gather in your lifetime enough sufficient funds for retirement so you can get along. Buy insurance to cover anything and everything. I'm not even going to ask how many of you have insurance on your phones. Folks, at my age, that's the most ridiculous question you could possibly ask. Insurance on a phone? And I'm thinking landline. Yeah. Go buy a cell phone. You'll see why you need insurance on your phone. You know, it's better to insure your phone than your car, probably, in most cases. We need to prepare all the time. The point is, we are concerned about the future. And the point is, we ought to be concerned about the future. And people around us are concerned that we are concerned for the future, because if you don't prepare for the future, you might become a burden to me. So prepare for the future. And Solomon in Ecclesiastes reminds us of how futile that whole preparation process is, right? And what did he say? Ecclesiastes 2:15. I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? I said in my heart that this is vanity, for of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. But you still make preparation. And Jesus' point in this story is that sinners are more diligent exercising human wisdom as they prepare for a future in a passing world than the followers of Christ are as they prepare for a future in eternity. Sons of light contrasted to the sons of this world. We are the ones who have been drawn to the light of God's truth. By the light of the world, Jesus Christ himself, to walk in the light of his truth. We are children of light. Everything about our lives ought to characterize the fact that we've come out of darkness into life. And of all the people in the world who ought to know that the passing stuff of this world is futile, we ought to know. So how do you use it? If you come at all on our Sunday evening services, by now you're convinced how true this is. As we've been working through Ecclesiastes and over and over and over, we're just told all of this stuff in this world is passing away. You can't count on it. Yeah, but what are you doing with it as it passes through your hands? Are you responsible for how you use it? Which brings us to the second question that we need to answer. Okay, how do we make friends with money? Is that what Jesus is saying? Verse 9. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. Now, when Jesus calls this passing stuff unrighteous wealth, He isn't saying that money in and of itself is evil. We already know what the scripture teaches about that. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. It is the love for money that is a root to all kinds of evil. Jesus simply referred to money as that which cannot inherit heaven. The stuff that you have cannot inherit heaven. Why? It's part of this world system. This whole world system is passing away. It is all temporary. And it is what we have that can't go to heaven. And it's a very, very large part of our lives. And we being the followers of Christ who have walking in the light of His truth are saddled with the responsibility of using these things that are not eternal for eternal good. Does that make sense? I mean, that's a real simple principle. You acknowledge these things are not eternal. They're passing. Yeah, what are you doing with it? Are you using it for eternal good? Notice how Jesus answers this question. How do you use money to make friends for eternity? He says, well, watch what the world does. The world makes friends with money. But the friends who are made by sinful friends using unrighteous money, they die. And according to Solomon, they're never heard from again. The lesson that Jesus teaches us is, no, wait, you do the same kind of thing. You take this money that's passing through your hands and you use it to make friends for eternity. You see, that's a very, very important truth. Money can be used to create methods. You ready? For sharing the gospel. Boy, is this simple. Jesus said, this is what you're supposed to be doing. You use your money to create methods for sharing the good news. Because when a sinner hears the good news of the gospel, God uses that gospel in the sinner's life, brings conviction of sin. The sinner, being under Holy Spirit conviction of sin, confesses that sin, repents of that sin, embraces Jesus Christ as the payment for that sin. That person is born again. That person will live forever in heaven. Guess where you're going? And you'll be with them forever. And you have friends in heaven you don't even know about and you haven't met yet. But they're there because of how you're using your money. That's a great principle. That's what Jesus would have us learn. Put your money to use now so that there will be these friends in heaven who will meet you and you will live with them forever. It's just plain good investment. Investing and sharing of the gospel is the wisest investment that we can possibly make. And I know that doesn't make sense to us in our human wisdom. Furthermore, Jesus teaches that faithfulness will gender even greater responsibility. Verse 10. One who's faithful in very little is also faithful in much. One who's dishonest in very little is going to be dishonest in much. And Jesus said, your character is going to be revealed in your relationship with small things. What do you do with the little things, the unimportant things? Which means never, ever, ever claim that if you had more money, you would invest in the gospel. Jesus is saying, that's what I'm telling you. I know your heart, I know your character, I know what I've given to you. And if you are faithful in the little things, you'll be faithful in the big things. If you're not faithful in the little I've given to you, don't even think about being faithful in the big things because you're not going to do it. I mean, remember the importance that Jesus put on that widow's two coins as she drops them in the treasury at the temple. And he says she gave more than all of these other people who gave out of their wealth. Faithfulness in the two coins. Faithfulness in the little things. Because the person who does not invest in eternal gospel work with what they have never will invest in gospel work. Now, how does it work? The application of the principle. Verse 11 to the end of the text here. Negative side, unfaithfulness yields negative consequences. Okay, the principle here is the question about unfaithfulness in wealth. Verse 11, if then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth. You see, now Jesus is just explaining what he said about if you're unfaithful in little things. Well, the little things, he's saying, is your wealth. Who is going to entrust to you the true riches? Now, that reference to unrighteous wealth is simply a reference to these passing things, this money, this possession that we have in this life. Are you faithful in the passing things God gives to you? Yes. Then you are going to receive true riches. You see, Jesus' argument up to this point is God is not going to trust you with true riches if you're hoarding money and not investing in his gospel work. What are true riches? That's the question we need to answer. I mean, if this is what God's going to give us, if we're faithful, he's going to give us these true riches. Obviously, whatever it is, it has to be eternal in nature because all through this story, that's what Jesus is contrasting. The passing temporal things with the eternal things. The true riches are eternal things. Now, what Jesus is not saying here is that if there's somebody in your church and they just will not give an offering, obviously they lost their salvation. You might hear that in some churches, but that's not what the Bible says. That's not the principle Jesus is teaching here. That would make for a very manipulative sermon. But that's not what Jesus is teaching. The idea here is that riches connected with God, riches that last in eternity, are true riches. And all of those are at God's disposal. He gives that gift. The riches that last for eternity connected with God. Now, you've read through the Bible enough, and we've preached enough here. You ought to be able to connect some dots right here. Say, oh, I think I know what this is talking about. You know, just Paul himself talks plenty about the rewards that we will receive as believers. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 8. He who plants and he who waters are one. Each will receive wages according to his labor. True riches. You plant the gospel. You till the soil. You water the plant. You might have the privilege of harvesting. Okay, that's investing well. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 14. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward, true riches. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart to each one. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. That's true riches. 2 Corinthians 5:10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive what? Well, the things that we've done in our flesh, our bodies, whether it be good or evil, that's a reward, that's the riches of God. But true riches may also refer not just to future blessings, but to spiritual blessings in this life. Because Jesus' warning seems to be that where there is failure in our lives right now to invest the passing stuff in his work, the result is going to be spiritual poverty in this life and shame in eternity. And what's so important about this whole argument that Jesus is giving in this story is now seen here. Because what he says is, you're a manager, and it's really not your stuff. It's your master's stuff that you're supposed to be investing. It's not your property. Verse 12. If you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? All possessions, all money, all wealth, 100% of it belongs to God. It's like the cattle on the thousand hills, the wealth in every mine. Okay, it's all God's. Everything you've ever touched financially, it's God's. It came from him first. They are his gifts to us. He is the resource. We are the managers. And he requires us to be faithful in what he gives to us. Why? Well, here's the final argument. Faithfulness to money is equivalent to unfaithfulness to God. You can only serve one master at a time. Verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one, love the other, he will be devoted to the one, despise the other. Money, wealth, possessions can very easily become your master. And if it does, it becomes a horrible taskmaster. It will determine how you think. It will decide how you feel. It will drive you to go to work. It will drive you to work more than you need to work. And it will drive you to get more of it. And that's just like digging a hole. You ever get stuck? Some of you know what it's like to get stuck in the snow. But let's be realistic. Do you ever get stuck in Carolina mud? Doesn't take much. And what do? Well, you're stuck, so you step on the gas pedal of the car, right? And you don't go anywhere, so what do? Step on it more. And you don't go, so you step on it more, and by now the tires are smoking, and you're not going anywhere. And that's what we do with possessions. When it becomes our master, we say, I need more, I need more, I need more, I need more. And it is a horrible taskmaster. And God says, you can't serve that master and me. You can serve God and use money to that end. You cannot serve money and use God. And that is the heresy of the health, wealth, prosperity doctrine. You cannot serve money and use God. In fact, you can't serve God and serve anything or anyone else. Simple conclusion. You cannot serve God and money. Now, there's little doubt that money really does play a very important part in our lives. It has to. Unfortunately, sometimes it serves a very powerful point in our lives. And very easily becomes a pernicious idol. And I think it is probably the idol of the American culture. You know, when we talk about idol worship, I think we're fair to have in our minds the first idol is a dollar sign. That is the American idol. You can't serve that. Serve God. You know, there used to be a time, maybe this was actually before my lifetime, though that's hard to believe. There used to be a time when a person would blush, especially a Christian would blush, if it was found out they made an awful lot of money. Or worse, but they were focused on money regardless of how much they made. Now even Christians do this. Even Christians get wrapped up in this grab for more gain. And I wonder how sad it's going to be for those kinds of people who went through life claiming that they really did love Jesus, only to stand before Jesus in the end and realize they invested nothing. They didn't invest anything in his work. I think today is just a good day for all of us to kind of step back and take a breather here. Maybe go home and talk about it. And look at your books. Just kind of go down through all the line items there. Just like we do at our quarterly meetings. We look at those line items. We spent this here, and spent this here, and spent this here. And ask this question. How does the line item labeled self line up with the line item labeled God? Whew. I mean, we just know that the money we invest in ourselves generally far outweighs the money we invest in the gospel. And that's Jesus' point. And he uses this awful bad manager to demonstrate to us how important it is for us to use all the stuff that's passing through our hands to prepare for the future. I had a history teacher/football coach in high school. I don't remember hardly anything he ever said. Kind of like a preacher. Yeah. But I do remember one thing he said over and over and over. The future belongs to those who prepare for it. I bought into that. And that's what Jesus teaches us. There is a future, and we have opportunity to invest in that future right now. And once we get to heaven, we're done investing. Then we start enjoying the rewards. So how are you investing?